Okay, looks like everyone's sitting down, so I'll just get started. So this work I'm going to discuss today is things I've been working on for some time now, on how a compact body spiraling into a galactic mass black hole, the kind of gravitational waves it generates, and the gravitational back reaction on this system. What I'm going to focus on in this talk in particular is what we can learn by measuring these gravitational waves about black holes. Okay, so very roughly, these are binaries that you create, or that nature creates, if you have some kind of a compact body down in a galactic core that gets scattered through multi-body interactions onto a fairly strong field elliptical orbit of the black hole at the center of the galaxy. Gravitational wave emission will cause this orbit to shrink and circularize reasonably rapidly, and depending upon the mass and the spin of this black hole, it will eventually get down to a regime where all of the gravitational waves it emits are right in the sensitivity band of the planned LISA space-based gravitational wave antenna. At around that point, this thing spends something like a year spiraling through the very deep, strong field of the black hole and generates something like 100,000 gravitational wave cycles as it spirals in this very strong field regime. And so if we can track the phase, if we can measure these gravitational waves over this year and sort of track the evolution of the waveform over these 100,000 or so oscillations, this suggests that it seems like this would be a good way to make detailed measurements of the strong field nature of black holes. Now, I want to make a quick side note here, and an apology to someone in the audience. I'm going to focus on a case when the inspiraling body is a black hole or a neutron star. The reason for this is that I want my inspiraling body to not really deform or vibrate very much as it goes into the black hole. Okay, the reason for this is that I want the inspiral to depend only on the physics of the large black hole space-time. If this thing is vibrating, I can learn something very interesting about that body, or I can see other really interesting things happen. But it sort of messes up this idea of making, it could in principle at least, mess up this idea of making precision measurements of the black hole properties. There is a lot of room for interesting effects to happen. There's a really nice poster outside by Avery Broderick, who I forgot had joined this collaboration, Roger Blanford and Yasser Rator. So I encourage everyone to go out and take a look at that. This is work that shows what happens if you have a white dwarf in spiral, and there's a resonance between the G-modes and the orbital frequencies. But at any rate, so my main focus, what I want to talk about in this talk, is what happens if I have a really compact object spiraling in to a black hole, how I can learn something about the strong field nature and the structure of the black hole. So those are nice words. It's nice to have some kind of a plan of how to actually do this. The way we consider doing this kind of a measurement is to map orbital timescales, things like different orbital frequencies, to a multipolar description of a black hole spacetime. The various orbital timescales directly imprint themselves on the gravitational waveform. So if we track the waveform and the evolution of these frequencies, we learn something about the multipolar structure of the object. So the example I like to use to give you some intuition about this is geodesy. This is measuring the shape of the Earth using satellite orbits. We can take the Earth's potential and expand it in spherical harmonics. And so the harmonic expansion, I lose the microphone here. The harmonic expansion of the Earth's gravitational potential depends on a series of spherical harmonic, these coefficients that tell you something about the shape of the Earth. And so, for instance, if the Earth has a quadrupolar bulge, then the phi frequency tends to advance relative to the theta frequency, so you end up with some kind of an orbital precession. This one of these coefficients encodes that time scale, the time scale corresponding to that precession. And then you can use something like Poisson's equation to relate these coefficients to the shape of the Earth. Okay, so what we want to do is a similar kind of geodesy, but for black holes. And there's a word for that. At least there will be a word for that, I hope. This is bothrodesy. Bothrodesy is geodesy for black holes. It descends from a word which I had thought was Greek for garbage pit, bothros, although I've since been told it actually means sewer. So I'm not so keen on it anymore, but anyhow. it's a particularly powerful variant of geodesy because black holes have a very special multipolar structure. The no-hair theorem tells me that everything about this black hole space-time description is encapsulated in two numbers, the mass and the spin. And I can define a family of multipole moments in which the mass is the zeroth moment and the spin is the first moment. If I know those two, then I know what the third moment, or rather sort of in this notation, L equals 2 is determined if I know L equals 0 and L equals 1. If I have some other body, so sort of sketch here, it's something like a Borg cube, the multiple moments are completely arbitrary. They're determined by the distribution of masses and mass currents within this object. And so there is no particular relationship between one or the other. If I know the first two, I don't know anything about the third. It depends on how things are distributed here. So this tells me that if I can measure three moments, that's sufficient to falsify whether I have a black hole or not. Okay? If I measure L equals 0 and L equals 1, and L equals 2 is not consistent with this relationship, this is not a black hole. On the other hand, if you can measure more than that, you can begin to stringently constrain the black hole nature of this object. Okay, so full disclosure, my background is in classical general relativity, and to a general relativity theorist, all cows are spherical. We really should take a sanity check before we get too excited about doing beautiful science with this. In particular, you might want to wonder, are these kind of events interesting and are abundant enough that this is an interesting science? Can we actually hope to see enough of these to do something with it? And as I'll argue in a moment by basically appealing to other people's work, they probably are. And we also want to ask, will the astrophysical environment in which these inspirals occur, is something going to go on there that will damage the inspiral signature? In other words, are we really going to be measuring properties of the black hole spacetime, or am I going to be probing something else? Okay, so let's answer the first one. For them to be abundant enough to be interesting, what we need to have are enough massive black holes in a particular mass range out to a distance of a few gigaparsec. This mass range corresponds to the large black hole mass such that deep, strong field orbits are emitted at the right frequencies that the LISA detector could, it's in the main sensitivity band of the LISA detector. And this distance of a few gigaparsecs is out of distance about which the planned sensitivity of LISA would be such that it could measure these things. So these numbers here, this range of masses and this distance, they're set by the LISA characteristics. And so then the real question is, how many black holes are there in this mass range out to this distance, and how often do the captures happen? So I am not an expert in this kind of thing, but one of the experts is actually in the audience. The estimates that have been done suggest that the rate is likely to be high. People have looked at this, and so, for instance, a couple years ago, the rate reference I used to usually refer to was by Sigurdsson and Rees. They estimated that going out to these distances, you would see several tens of these events happening a year. Mark Freitag has been doing computations of the evolution of these stellar clusters, and if you fold that in with our understanding of how many black holes are in this mass range, he and Sterl Finney are finding out that there actually could be quite a few more of these events going on at once. I would say that this is somewhat, these numbers are all up in the air, they're going to be changing, but it's encouraging that at the very least these are interesting enough that we can contemplate, or they're high enough we can contemplate doing interesting science. The other question is, how about things that are going to dirty up the signal? So if we have one of the inspirals happening in some kind of an active galaxy, you're not going to be doing really space-time physics. Okay? In this case, your small body that is spiraling into the black hole is just going to be interacting with a disk. It's going to be just basically probing the accretion disk. It's going to be having drag acting on it by all the material that's down there. And really, all you're going to be seeing is that. You're not going to be seeing gravitational waves from space-time behavior. Ramesh Narayan asked, well, what happens if the accretion flow is ADAF, or something, one of the low luminosity flows? He used an ADAF for a specific calculation. He found in this case that the drag due to material accreting onto the black hole is in fact negligible. If we look at the ratio of the torque exerted by the drag versus the torque exerted by the gravitational waves, if the small body that's spiraling in is a black hole, the drag is 10 to the minus 15 times smaller than the torque exerted by the gravitational waves. Okay, that's tiny. If it's a white dwarf, you do, because the white dwarf is less massive and has a larger cross-section, it's a much more significant effect, but it's still pretty small. And so other models that have been positive that things like the CDAF and the wind models to explain low luminosity accretion flows probably would give even lower drags because there'd be less gas density down there for things to interact with. So this suggests that many of the normal galaxies that are not active, the inspiral really only depends on space-time geometry. So I am hopeful then that this picture probably is fairly realistic. We may be able to, by modeling these sources and understanding gravitational wave emission in these cases, we can do something like try to measure this multipolar structure and learn something about compact objects from gravitational wave inspirals. However, there is certainly a lot of work that needs to be done. So let me just go through what's understood now, and then I'll discuss what I'm going to go through in this talk. we have a pretty good understanding of what, if we want to actually measure these multiples, okay, we need to have some kind of an object to falsify against. And so we need to have some kind of a formalism for describing something like a black hole with a distorted multipolar structure. I want to, in some sense, measure those distortions, of course. At the moment, we really only have a good weak field description of how that works. And this was used by Fenton Ryan, a former PhD student at Caltech, to show that this idea of Bothroticy should work in principle. He was able to show that with extremely unfavorable assumptions, he made some assumptions that were sort of unfavorable from the measurement and wave generation perspective that nonetheless made his calculation easier. With those unfavorable assumptions, three moments were easy to measure. And remember, three moments is what we need to falsify whether we have a black hole or not. Some kind of a strong field generalization is obviously needed for this. Another thing that I worry about, although others may not worry about quite so much in my field, is the influence of the small body that is spiraling in, the influence its spin will have on the orbital dynamics and then on the gravitational waveforms that are generated. If the small body is spinning, basically the small body is, if a spinning small body is something like a little magnetic magnetic dipole, and it will interact with the magnetic type gravitational field of the black hole to cause precessions to occur. Concomitant to those precessions, the inclination and eccentricity of the orbit will oscillate. And so that will lead to some interesting structure that may be difficult to handle, although the people who have been studying this at Caltech, Stroll Finney and his student Michael Hartle, seem to think it's not such an important effect. This talk, what I'm going to describe to you are what the orbital dynamics look like for test bodies. This is the dynamics that source the gravitational waveforms, and then how radiative back reaction works on those test bodies and the gravitational waves that it generates. So the dynamics are fully understood, and we are getting a handle. We have fully understood the back reaction for a few special cases that are illustrative, and we're beginning to understand how to do things generically. And I just lost the microphone. Hang on. Okay. So let's talk about the orbital dynamics for a moment. So I can discuss Kerr black hole orbits using many of the same notions we would use for just a simple Newtonian orbit. Okay, I put this thing on an orbit. It's going to have some notion of a radius, which I've labeled P. It'll have some eccentricity. I can use P and E to describe the periastron, the apastron of the orbit. And it'll have some inclination with respect to, you can define it with respect to the black hole spin or the equatorial plane. This is a useful way of parameterizing the orbit, but this kind of picture I've drawn here is very misleading because, as Dimitrios Saltos told us earlier today, there are three distinct periods that describe these orbits. Okay, there's a time to cover the radial range, which generically is larger than the time it takes for this thing to oscillate in theta, which in turn is also larger than the time for this thing to go around the phi axis. So when we fold in this more accurate description of the dynamics, what you get is a structure to these orbits that looks like they sort of, they essentially ergodically fill a torus in the physical space near the black hole. You end up with this sort of volume-filling orbits where they fill up this space between some minimum and maximum angles and between some minimum and maximum radii. And they have what I'll describe why we call it this in a moment. They have sort of a zoom-whirl character arising from the very difference, the large differences between these frequencies. Now, in the weak field, these frequencies are fairly well understood. If I look at the difference between the frequency associated with the phi and the theta motion, you get just Lenz-Turing precession, which is essentially just frame dragging. Likewise, the difference between the phi and the r motion just gives me perihelion precession. These are, in the weak field, relatively small numbers. In the strong field, though, as I'll show you in just a second, these numbers can be very large. Differences between these two frequencies can be very large. So what I'm showing here right now is an illustration of what some of these motions actually look like for a particular strong field orbit, just to give you a sense of what we're dealing with. So this top thing just shows, for a given orbit, what the radius looks like as a function of time. So you see it's moving from its minimum to its maximum, to its minimum, maximum, blah, 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 back and forth in an eccentric orbit. As it's doing that, though, the theta motion is very different. Okay, this middle frame here shows me the projection of this motion onto the black hole's spin axis. When it's at small radius, it oscillates something like three times in theta before it goes back out to large radius and moves slowly. So this thing's moving fairly slowly out at large radius, but when it gets in, it oscillates a couple times, and then it goes back out and moves slowly again. If I do the same exercise, but I look at the motion as it's projected onto the equatorial plane of the black hole, the same thing is true in spades. This thing comes in close to the black hole, and it actually whips around the hole something like eight times before it comes back in again. This is what we call the zoom whirl motion. It sort of zooms out at large radius, and it comes in, whirls around several times, and then it kind of zooms back out again. Okay? This effect I like to emphasize, this is nothing more than perihelion precession, but it's perihelion precession on steroids. We're doing this in an extremely strong field, and we have very strong frame dragging going on. And so rather than getting something like 53 degrees of precession per century, you get something like 20 pi radians per orbit. Okay, so that's essentially dynamics of Kerr orbits in a nutshell. Let me just describe to you now how one understands the gravitational waves that are emitted from these systems and how they drive the evolution of these orbits. So strong field radiation reaction in this particular case is not so hard to do because the mass ratio of the system gives us a natural expansion parameter. In a moment, Eric Gergel-Horn is going to talk about a problem that is much more difficult to pose because he's going to talk about binaries in which the two objects in the binary are of comparable mass. In this case, though, because my small body is so much less massive than the big black hole, I can sort of do a first-order expansion of the description of the space-time. And rather than solving Einstein's equations numerically, I can do a perturbative variant of Einstein's equations and solve that numerically, which turns out to be much easier to do. I'm not going to go through the details of how this formalism is actually set up, but I'll be happy to discuss with anyone. I use something called the Tucholsky equation, which basically computes quantities that are related, the radiative quantities related to this metric perturbation. I also use the fact that when this mass ratio is extreme enough, the evolution can be thought of as adiabatic in the sense that on short timescales, it just looks like a geodesic orbit. It looks like a normal black hole orbit. And so a normal black hole orbit is you can sort of just parameterize it with initial conditions and a set of constants. And I sort of let these constants slowly evolve due to things being changed by the perturbation. And I sort of evolve it through a sequence of orbits like this. Yesterday in his talk, Cole Miller suggested that it may be possible to use a formalism similar to this to compute gravitational waves in sort of an intermediate mass ratio regime. What I suspect is that sort of this mass ratio expansion may work out in that case, but that this adiabatic approximation may not. So this is one of the things we're thinking about. For this case, though, where I'm talking about something like a 10 solar mass body going into a million solar mass black hole, it works out very well. Okay, so this is all work in progress. Let me describe to you cases that are very well understood right now. So I'm going to describe to you some of the work. I'm going to present to you some results from work that I have done in which you restrict orbits to be circular. Circular in this case means that they are at constant coordinate radius but are inclined with respect to the equatorial plane. Okay, they don't actually have a very circular geometry. They kind of have this interesting winding structure to them. This orbit will then have two frequencies associated with the motion in theta and phi, and gravitational radiation will cause them to secularly change the radius and the inclination angle. This turns out to work because a theorem has been proven that if I have an orbit that starts out with precisely zero eccentricity, it will remain at zero eccentricity on a secular time scale. A second case that has been solved exactly, and the paper is in progress right now, is similarly restricted, but rather than having orbits that are of constant radius on dynamical timescales, they are in the equatorial plane. Okay, so Daniel Kenefick and Kostas Kalanthadakis are working on a case in which you have orbits that are eccentric but confined to the equatorial plane, and so your two frequencies are associated with the motion in R and the motion in phi. And in this case, their eccentricity and semi-major axis change on secular timescales. The generic case that several of us are working on right now, this transparency is out of date because this collaboration is actually bigger than this at this point, are orbits that have significant eccentricity and inclination associated with them. We have some crude results to give you a notion of what's going on, and there are still a few theoretical bugbears that we're dealing with, too, that we have some approximations to deal with, but we don't have a very rigorous notion of how to evolve these things, but I'm pretty confident that we're almost there. So what I'm going to show you now, and then I'm going to play for you some results from, are how inspirals behave in this case in which you start off with a circular orbit and let gravitational radiation act on it. So what you end up finding is that as this thing evolves, its radius and its inclination angle slowly change. So here are some trajectories that I helpfully forgot to label. This describes what happens when we have a one solar mass body spiraling into a million solar mass black hole. In this particular case, the hole is spinning at nearly the maximal value. It's 0.2% from the maximal value. And let's see, this dotted line here is the generalization of the notion of the ISCO, the innermost stable circular orbit, to a Kerr black hole. When these orbits come in, gravitational radiation causes them to shrink and their inclination to change slightly on a slow secular timescale until it hits this dynamical instability, at which point it just plunges into the black hole. As I do this, as I compute these trajectories, you see here that the numbers that I'm showing are the accumulated time it takes to spiral in from a radius of 4m until it hits that instability, which is of order a year and a half or so for this particular set of parameters, the number of times it orbits the phi axis, and the number of oscillations that it makes in theta as it does so. And you can see those two numbers are fairly different. This is because of the strong modulations that are induced by frame dragging. Now, these modulations are made a lot more clearly if I show you what a gravitational waveform looks like. One thing I like to say is that it's not very useful to see a gravitational waveform. It's a lot more useful to actually hear it. And so what I've done is I'm going to play for you what it would sound like if I took the gravitational waveform corresponding to this in-spiral and changed it into a sound. So at the beginning, that's the wrong button. The beginning, it has this character that's something like a badly tuned motorcycle. The modulations that you're hearing correspond to this thing orbiting around the phi axis with a modulation induced by its oscillations in theta. So you can hear the chirp occurring as it sweeps up to higher frequencies and the amplitude grows. It eventually gets loud enough that it gets somewhat uncomfortable. Sorry to those of you in the front row. Now, an interesting thing to note here are how the modulations change. Okay, so that is this particular end spiral here. So I want to comment on two things. First of all, we noted towards the end, you may have heard sort of other voices come into the song. What's basically going on here is that as you move over much of this in-spiral, you're just hearing the main quadrupole harmonic associated with this thing's motion. Corresponds to the usual notion of the quadrupole moment of the system. As you get down into the strong field, other moments of the system begin to radiate very strongly as well. And so you start hearing other harmonics, other voices that correspond to those other harmonics singing. In addition, the various modulations started to change. Let me do it on time. And there's a simple explanation for that. If you take a look at how the phi and the theta frequency evolved as it spiraled in. Basically, the phi frequency just monotonically increased and eventually limits to a particular value. The limit that this thing approaches corresponds to the rotation frequency of the black hole itself. Basically, it's really deep in the ergosphere in this region, and it's getting close to the event horizon of the black hole. And so, in some sense, it sort of latches onto the rotation of the space-time, and it just gets dragged around by it, and there's nothing it can do. On the other hand, the theta frequency, it starts out climbing, but turns around and drops. This is just gravitational redshift entering here. This thing gets very deep into the strong field, and so the gravitational redshift kills it off. One more sense of full disclosure. Many of you will no doubt have noticed that it took far less than a year and a half to play this sound. Basically, so that A, we could hear this, and B, we wouldn't die while waiting for it to finish. I tweaked the masses such that everything would be a little more convenient for us. Okay, so let's see. Let me just show you one other result that's kind of interesting. When I calculated that in-spiral trajectory, I calculated the rates at which the radius and the inclination angle changed due to fluxes of energy that were leaking out to infinity and we're going down the event horizon. Likewise, fluxes of angular momentum going out to infinity, and we're leaking down the event horizon. Now, it's very common in these kind of calculations for people to ignore the flux going down the event horizon. Much less flux tends to be absorbed by the black hole than is radiated to infinity. And so for many years, this was, or in many calculations, an appropriate thing to do is just to ignore that horizon flux and see what happens, or and compute your models that way. So, an interesting experiment is to see what happens in this case, if I ignore this horizon flux. The naive prediction is that there is less energy being carried away from the orbit, and so the spiral in will be slower. Okay, after all, it's not leaking as quickly, so the spiral in won't happen as quickly as it did. Well, when you actually try that, you see that this prediction is actually exactly wrong. If you ignore the flux of energy that supposedly is going into the horizon, it actually spirals in more quickly. This suggests that there is more energy leaking out of the system without this horizon flux than with it. Okay? The only way that would make sense is if energy was, in some sense, coming out of the event horizon. And the fact that we have a really strong ergosphere here tells us this is, in fact, exactly what's going on. We are seeing one way to picture what's going on here is this is a manifestation of superradiant scattering. There's actually a somewhat cleaner but mathematically equivalent way to view this, which was elucidated by Jim Hartle in the early 70s, and can be thought of as tidal coupling. As the small body is spiraling into the black hole, it will raise a tide on the event horizon, so it will distort it. Thanks, Pete. Because of the rapid rotation, though, the bulge associated with this tide will get dragged forward and will then exert torque back on the small body. This torque is in such a direction that it would tend to increase this body's orbital speed. And so this is operationally how spin energy from the black hole can be transferred into an orbital, basically it's spin angular momentum of the black hole gets transferred into orbital angular momentum of the particle. This is the same reason why the moon faces the Earth. Okay, it's this exact same kind of mechanism that leads to tidal couplings in planets and various other phenomena. From the fact that we need rapid rotation in order to get this thing to advance ahead of the inspiraling body, this would tell you this is probably only going to be important for rapidly rotating black holes. And in fact, you can show that if the black hole spin is something around 0.35, this effect, that's the point at which this effect actually begins to change sign. Okay, if it's actually a Schwarzschild black hole with zero rotation, it will behave in the intuitive way. The hole will absolutely absorb energy.
Does the bulge move ahead of the orbiting body because it's a dynamical tide, or
Exactly. Best I can say in this menu is it's weird. There's a way to there's a formalism for understanding tides on black holes in which one treats the black hole's event horizon as a viscous membrane, and it's associated with the viscosity of the there's a viscous-like term in the equations that determines the time scale for this thing to want to sort of snap back, and this is sort of rotating fast enough that doesn't act quickly enough to matter. But this is that was all worked out by Jim Hartle back in about 73 or 74. So, okay, let me just move on to the last topic I want to discuss today, which is what we're doing so far to understand this generic case in which the orbit is inclined and eccentric. A technical problem here, as I mentioned, I like to sort of treat these things as evolving through a sequence of absolute orbits, of geodesic orbits. And to do that, I need to evolve the orbital constants. With the current radiation reaction scheme, we don't have a rigorous notion of how to evolve all of them. We can only evolve the two that are limit to energy and z component of angular momentum. There's a third one, the so-called Carter constant, that rigorously we don't quite understand. However, it turns out a very high-quality approximation is to just evolve that third constant such that a particular definition of inclination angle remains constant. Okay, this is almost intuitively what one would have guessed. This turns out to be exactly true in the case that the black hole does not rotate. And it's true to very high accuracy even if it does rotate. Work in progress right now, some of the stuff that some of us are working on, is taking the code that built the sound I just played for you and extending it to include this approximation and building in the full generic source. We're not quite at that stage yet. And so I'm just going to show you some snapshots of what things look like in a very crude approximation in which we just take strong field orbits and act on them using the weak field quadrupole formula. This is guaranteed to be wrong, but at least gives you some illustration of what things, qualitatively, how things are likely to behave. So in this case, it actually is kind of cute to show you visually what the waveform looks like. You have quiet stretches followed by quick bursts. These quick bursts, it actually oscillates something like 8 times in here. This is the zoom whirl structure. In particular, this is the whirl that one gets when this thing gets close to the black hole and then orbits many times before it comes back out. Now, if we take this and we turn it into a sound, we get... sound like this. Popping is obviously my speaker's going to help, but most of that sound was just the gravitational waveform. The sequence of pops we heard at the beginning here, that is nothing more than this structure. Every time it passes through one of these, it makes a little pop, and it's silent as it passes through this stretch. And as the body spirals in, these pops get closer and closer together as the eccentricity of the orbit is decreased and it becomes more and more circular. In this calculation, it actually becomes perfectly circular, and so it goes over to a continuum associated with it being circular in spiral before it plunges into the black hole. We are actually pretty confident that that is wrong based on the other limit where we can do the calculation exactly, and so we're working on ways right now to fix that up. So let me just summarize. That basically gives you a snapshot of where this field is. Let me talk about what we plan to do next. So as I already mentioned, we're taking the rigorous codes that describe this thing based on the Tucholsky equation. We're extending them right now to handle the more generic case, so that rather than playing you sort of a crude approximation like that, next time I give this talk, hopefully I can play something rigorous. There is work in progress to test the validity of this approximation that the inclination angle remains constant. It's based on an entirely different subset of the relativity community that are working on so-called self-force approximations. It's really mathematical, and I can't understand what they're talking about most of the time. We have an issue of understanding how to put spin on the small body, seeing whether this has a major impact. And then finally, once this is all done, we need to reformulate this such that we can actually measure the multipolar structure of this object. That's really our goal in the end. And if I make just a family of models that are only based on black holes, I really can't falsify whether it's not a black hole. I suspect the way we're going to start is to do sort of a perturbative modification of the multipoles. We're just going to write down the multipolar structure of a Kerr black hole and shift it away from this a little bit. Then we just need to build a data analysis strategy to measure all this and launch LISA and hopefully measure it. Thank you.
I was thinking that the total amount of gravitational radiation, the total amount of energy, is probably sort of like the energy of a small hole. And then at the end, in the last however many milliseconds it takes to really go in, it could radiate that much again. Is that right, roughly?
So during the course of the whole in spiral, the amount that comes off is some, at most, 5 or 10% of the mass of the black hole. It's basically the binding energy. The energy that's coming out of this thing is you're converting the binding energy of the binary into gravitational waves. And so some finite percentage of the body comes off in that. And then, in principle, you could probably, when this thing comes in, you would sort of drive ringing modes of a black hole, which will again radiate some small percentage of the small body. My gut feeling is it wouldn't actually be comparable to the mass of the body itself. It would probably be somewhat smaller, quite a bit smaller.
Power was much higher, the power radiated on the way in.
Might be, yeah. This is something which we can model fairly easily as well, though, and I'll be blunt, makes cool sounds. So,
if you wanted to have hundreds or thousands of these events going at once, how are you going to separate them?
That's an issue. First of all, we don't know if there's actually going to be 100 or 1,000 of them going off at once, but there is actually some concern that this, rather than being an opportunity to measure the structure of spacetimes, this may be in some sense a confusion-limited source of noise in a certain frequency band. One of the things that people are working on right now is assessing how much of an issue that is, whether there is some kind of a separation that can be done. I mean, it may turn out that some fraction of them, you may only be able to do the really good science with the closest ones of these if this is the case. So we're in the process. People are in the process of assessing that.
What are your thoughts about the chaotic behavior of these systems when you introduce a spin for the test particle?
I don't believe it's an issue.
I
don't believe it's an issue.
Okay.
People who have looked at the issue of whether the end spiral develops chaotically, so I should give some background to this. There has been some numerical work done that suggests that if the small body that's spiraling into the black hole is itself spinning, then it will be hypersensitive to initial conditions, and they've integrated the equations ignoring radiative back reaction to show that the phase-based trajectories diverge exponentially. Now, there are two caveats to that. First is they did not include back reaction. The time scale for that expansion of phase-based to occur, if one uses realistic parameters, is far, far, far longer than the back reaction time scale in this regime. Now, the other caveat is if they use realistic parameters. I can give you a citation to a paper, one of the papers that actually found in spiral to occur. That found chaos to occur in the in-spiral. For that to happen, the in-spiraling body had to have an angular momentum that was, I believe, 1,000 times the maximal value allowed by the Kerr metric. If the in-spiraling body is itself a black hole, I'm not going to lose much sleep over that. If it's a neutron star, I'm not going to lose much sleep over that.
Scott, are you referring to John 11?
No, not John 11 stuff. This was, although it's tangentially related to that.
Because that work didn't even show.
That work didn't even show chaos.
Divergence.
No, it just.
divergence of the orbit is actually linear throughout the timescale dimension.
Which is why.
No formal,
that's right. And that's.
The orbit is very complicated in phase space. It's not counted.
Yeah, so there may be complicated precessions associated with the various precessions that go on to this that can influence the body, but it will not be chaotic. And I do not, if the mass ratio is extreme, as I discussed here, the magnitude of the precessional effects and how they color the waveform are strongly suppressed. And so it appears, this is when I referred to elliptically Sterl-Finney and Mike Hartle's result, that this is probably not a problem. This is what they were able to show is that with these extreme mass ratios, the influence of the spin-spin precessions are very small.
I'd like to ask, there was one paper that that estimated that there was comparable amount of energy radiated during the merger and the ring down to what we had during the in-spiral phase.
If the black holes were of comparable mass.
If they're comparable mass, okay.
Yeah.
How many of the 100 to 1,000 per year that you were talking about might occur will be of the kind that we heard about yesterday, where there's actually already a binary system, and this is something
that again was sort of a different situation in which they were talking about binaries of comparable masses that form from
that's
galaxy mergers
of
the style that I was just discussing here. Yeah. Once one of these captures occur, the time scale for this thing to evolve downward, get into the Lisa band, and then plunge in the black hole is relatively short. It's sort of order centuries, and so probably are centuries of thousands of years, and so. The odds of having two of these things happening at once is pretty low. It'd be kind of neat if it happened, but it'd be pretty low.
In terms of whether you can separate these different signals, I think comparing the number you have with how many frequency bins you have and the useful frequency range is useful.
Step one, yes.
So it may be there are enough frequency bins in which you're getting the information that 100 or 1,000 really isn't a problem.
Right.
Yes.
At least they have some directionality.
Yes, it has. I mean, so for signals, the rule of thumb is that if your signal lasts long enough that the orbital, the Lisa constellation moves through about a radian of its orbit, you can sort of localize it on the sky to tens of arc minutes to a degree, something like that. And if it lasts longer, you can do somewhat better. And so that could be one of the things that you might be able to use to distinguish some of these from. You still, I mean, it's by the standards of any kind of telescope, it's pretty poor. But gravitational waves, by their nature, are just difficult to localize. But this reduces, this gives you a certain number of boxes on the sky that you could presumably use to discriminate against things. So these are exactly the kind of issues people are thinking about, whether this can be used to separate some of these things.
Any other questions? If not, let's